Should you attempt to retranslate my record from the physical into the spiritual, that you may comprehend the truth as I behold it, let me offer one suggestion, by attention to which at least half your difficulty will be cleared away. Death works one change, and it is this. In the process of dissolution, everything is altered except yourself. Old things pass away, and all things become new. But you will remain unmoved, unchanged, as the one world makes its exit and another its entrance in the theater of your life. This transformation is effected in the twinkling of an eye when the wand of the magician Death is waved. The material will fade away like the baseless fabric of a vision, ever after to appear as a vague and shadowy substance which must be sought for and be but dimly visible to the newly acquired state. While that world, upon whose eternal shores your feet will rest, will leap from the realm of vision into a solid and startling reality, having foundations which never can be removed, since they are laid deep down in the bosom of infinity, and whose inhabitants have solved the birth pangs of immortality. Bear this in mind, and read the following pages in the light of this suggestion. Then you will understand why I have not hesitated to use that language, however unworthy for the other reasons, which conveys to you the idea that the scenes among which I move are, to me at least, as real and solid as the earth at present appears to you. Just another thought which offers food for meditation and reflection, and may help to remove the impression that my statement of spiritual deformity is erroneous and imaginative. Parental profligacy, immorality, ignorance, accident, and 100 other prenatal influences produce physical and mental distortions in a child. Why, then, should it be illogical to assert that in like manner, spiritual errors, unnatural ideas, and bigoted restrictions generate corresponding malformations and disfigurements in the soul, when it is set free from the flesh in which its shape and lineaments have been molded? Whether you may be able to satisfy yourself on the reasonableness of this point or not, the fact remains the same, and the time is not far distant when you will recognize its truth and appreciate the justice of the law by which it is governed. Be not deceived. The diseases of the soul resulting from personal sin are only removed and cured by slow and painful processes, but the unavoidable defects caused by others' sin or force of circumstances have a speedy rectification in such corrals as that to which I draw your attention. But to return to my digression. Very narrowly did I watch the Assyrian as he applied himself to the removal of those torturing restrictions. At the first, I must confess, it appeared to be a useless labor of love upon which he was engaged, since there was scarcely an indication of life remaining in the sufferer. Presently, however, she gave evident signs that she was still sensible to the pain they caused, but even then I thought it would be greater kindness to let her die in peace, rather than disturb her when too late to save. For in that moment of sympathy I had forgotten that it was impossible for her to die any more, since death itself was dead. With more tender care than a mother could have shown to an ailing child, the soft and gentle hands of that physician loosed and threw aside each bond, until at length the last was taken away, and she lay at perfect liberty. She felt the freedom, and glad to make an effort to use it, endeavored with considerable success to turn, yawned, and stretched out her arms. Then, finding that all restraint was gone, she finally straightened herself upon the couch, and rolling over, fell at once into an easy and refreshing sleep. The whole movement was the spontaneous action of a person who, waking from a troubled dream, before sufficient rest had been obtained, and feeling the terror of the nightmare broken, at once sinks back again to sleep, without fully being roused to consciousness. With what interest and sympathy Siamides watched her progress can better be imagined than described, until she lay in that quiet and comfortable repose to which she had hitherto been a stranger. Then he was satisfied, and turned to give his attention to the next case. All my powers of observation were attracted to the one individual. The further work of liberation would be more or less a repetition of what had already been accomplished. And as there was much I could not understand, I judged a fitting opportunity had arrived to seek some explanation. Therefore, turning to my companion, I asked, "Will you explain what these bonds are, and how such deformities are possible here?" "I have no doubt," he replied, "but that this service is full of wonder and amazement to you. It must of necessity be so, until you grow familiar with our law and mode of existence, until you learn how scrupulously this life is a corollary of the one you leave behind. Hypocrisy, sham, and cant are masks which are torn off as you come through the mists, and the real man, whether base or noble, stands undisguised, able to read and to be read of all men. With us no subterfuge is available for the concealment of unpleasant deformity, no matter whether it arises from your own sin or the neglect and criminality of another. Everything is known. To the practiced eyes of Siamides, Krishna, and thousands of such ministers engaged in their noble work, the real author and source of every such malformation can be told at a glance. And by an inexorable law, impossible to evade, the penalty and punishment of every wrong falls upon the offender. In this you will see there is a balancing of accounts, and a righteous retribution for the deeds done in the body. It is a sad mistake to say that death levels all men, and that this life is a new one, while the record of the old one has been wiped out with the sponge of death. All life is a continuation of that which had gone before, and entering here, you have but turned over the page to commence another chapter. The story and plot are the same. In this you will find that the mistakes of the past are rectified, overdue accounts have to be settled, and compensation awarded to those who have unjustly suffered. Men are here weighed in the balances of God, appraised by a valuer whose judgment is righteous, and against whose verdict there is no appeal but that of repentance. You will find no bribery and corruption. Everything is sternly real. All men and things are just what they appear to be. The restrictions binding these friends have been worn in violence to their better judgment, but lacking power to conquer the forces opposed to them, they have become victims of circumstances, and have passed their lives in an irksome bondage, being dominated by wills and usages they could not successfully resist. If they had given a ready consent to custom and dogma, followed with unquestioning faith where others led, and been content to crush the right to think, they would have developed the required littleness of soul, without necessity to apply restraint. But they recognized the God within, and refused to still the voice calling them to newer, nobler, higher duties for the welfare of their kind. Their prophetic utterances were dangerous to a craft, hence the gag must be applied. Their eyes saw visions of coming glory for the weary and oppressed. Therefore, their sight must be distorted, lest the interests of a class be endangered. The intelligent vigor of the child proclaimed a leader in the man, and church and dogma forged letters to cripple his power, and force the noble stature of the giant into the contortions of the dwarf. You can see it was a battle to the death. Noble lives have been hindered from work, wasted, yea, worse, for whereas they were ordained for construction and deliverance, being forcibly tampered with, they have been perverted by party bigotry, and compelled to struggle for existence, instead of scattering the blessings they were designed to carry to their fellows. The result is to be seen in the wrecks which lie before us. Wasted opportunities, wasted intellects, wasted lives. For all these things, those who are responsible must be brought to judgment. Guilt must be righteously punished, while the excess of pain which the victim has endured must receive its legitimate compensation. With the punishment, we have nothing to do. The natural law of this life is fully adequate to that, and every guilty soul will reap the just harvest of the seed he has sown. It is that we may take part in the compensation that we are here. Justice demands that an instant liberation shall be given from those bonds, and life must be lavished upon the sufferers until we have helped to build up and invigorate their souls. Then each one shall reach the full development for which it was designed, and for which it wept and struggled, but was prevented by action of oppressors. But where do we find mercy and forgiveness in the administration of such inexorable justice? I asked. Every attribute of God has its legitimate sphere of operation, he replied, and the inviolate maintenance of each in its appointed order is essential to the continuance of the Almighty and all-wise perfection of our Father. But it is impossible for any one of these to usurp the jurisdiction of another. Suppose for a moment that mercy was allowed to withstand justice and prevail in any single instance. The immediate result would be an injustice, since to show mercy to the offender would be an injustice to the offended, unless, in turn, you show him mercy too. Carry this to its logical sequence, and you will be compelled to abolish justice in favor of mercy, in which case punishment and retribution would become an impossibility, law would be a dead letter, and sin, freed from fear or restraint, would revel in its license. But when we see the working of the attributes of God according to his divinely appointed plan, we find how infinitely wise has been the adaptation to the necessities of the human family in its development. Take those to which you have referred, mercy, justice, and forgiveness. Mercy operates on earth, where patience, forbearance, and long-suffering are so much needed during the early stages of the conscious existence of the soul. Imagine the catastrophe and disaster which would ensue if unerring justice was enthroned at such a crisis in life's history. Would there be any subsequent immortality to record? Unconscious, practically, of his whence and whither, an untutored experimentalist as to his powers and capabilities, failure and mistake, the law by which he shall develop and learn to understand himself, uncertain if it be right to gratify even the most ardent of his longings, filled with fear and trembling at the forces surrounding him, a volume of nature before him, of whose hieroglyphics he is ignorant, though called upon to read, himself the most profound mystery among the million other problems. Under such circumstances, how often would earth be swept clear of man, if justice was applied to every transgression of the law, that justice which is perfect as its framer? No, this attribute cannot be applied to such an undeveloped condition. What man could be found wild enough to imagine that it is? Is not rather the absence of justice so manifest as to be used for an argument against the existence of a God, while it has become a proverb among the nations that villainy is the heir to fortune, but honesty marries miss? Oppression, tyranny, and persecution are rampant. That might is right is the universal motto, practically both of politics and religion. The affluent and wealthy are the honored of the nations, the poor and needy, the curse and bane. Is this right, you will ask me? And I reply, 1,000 times no. But even the injustice of man is not strong enough to cause God to change the action of his attributes and substitute justice for mercy upon the earth. This universal custom is wrong, and man has gained enough knowledge to know that it is so. But God is long-suffering, that the oppressor may be able to redeem himself before he is brought in to judgment. Mercy pleads, while hope of restitution remains. But once let the law take hold of the offender, and the issue passes from the court of mercy to justice. The mists marking the boundary line between that state and this also form the vestibule of the hall of judgment, and every soul must pass through and receive its righteous verdict before it enters here. Mercy has no power to cross that threshold. The soul stands alone before that inscrutable tribunal, its own witness, its own judge. Hence its life deeds pass the sentence from which no appeal is possible. But forgiveness, what of that? I asked. That follows later, he replied. The penalties enforced by that justice are for wrongs committed against your fellow man. Such sins must be redeemed. They are never forgiven. For no one, not even God, has power to forgive a trespass against any other than himself, such being contrary to his own law. When the penalty for sins against his fellow has been righteously discharged, then the repentant soul has the power to ask forgiveness for his sin against God, which is always freely granted. But it is requisite that he be first reconciled to his brother. For only he that hath clean hands and a pure heart can ascend to the presence of God, where Christ will secure his full remission. I was silent before the unexpected elucidation of a difficulty which had always perplexed me, for I knew my instructor was not expounding his opinions, but actual facts, which were very widely opposed to all the ideas and teachings I had ever heard on earth. And yet they are fraught with the most momentous interest to every soul who has to pass the mists. And in the depths of my being I yearned again to discover some means whereby I could reach earth and make the revelation for the benefit of the blinded and the ignorant. My friend, however, did not leave me long to myself, but called my attention to what was passing in the arena. Every bandage and restriction had been removed, and all the patients lay free from the bonds with which earth had bound them. The order of procedure had been to take the most serious case first, and so on through the whole, that the resuscitation of all might be accomplished as simultaneously as possible. Very earnestly did I watch the gradual absorption of that mysterious spectre lake into which they had been carried, the withered limbs and contorted frames expanding and growing as they fed upon that strange nourishment, until every trace of color had been abstracted from the atmosphere in the vicinity of the couches whereon they lay. Then rays of magnetism were drawn from appointed individuals, according as the Assyrian required, to form some combination specially adapted to each case. These in turn being broken at the moment when the first traces of color seemed to evolve from the sleepers. This, I was informed, afforded the natural indication of the condition of each soul. By the exercise of that mystic power by which he weaved the unique decorations of that hall, Siamides now resolved the flowers, fruit, and bannerets round the arena and seats, and called them to bathe the sleepers with the mellowed influences produced by the combinations they had formed. The magnetism evolved from each individual had a sympathetic attraction for the corresponding color called into service, and was drawn in billowy clouds around the couches, over which they rolled to and fro in rhythmic time with the music born of the returning motion. Sweet and soothing was the lullaby it chanted, and the silent hush of the attendant thousands was a fitting accompaniment to the grateful psalm. Without a sign or movement from the director, who calmly watched the scene, the melody concluded. Every thirsty soul had drunk its fill, and the waves of life which yet remained lifted above our heads, leaving the sleepers beautiful in all the soul's expansion, and waiting for nothing but a waking kiss to rouse them to a life of which as yet they were unconscious. The work was done, the victory accomplished. But the victor betrayed no pride at the conquest in his deep humility. I did not need to be told that the final number of that life-giving chorale was at hand. But what new powers would it develop? Were there still phases of magnetic wonder to be revealed? Other mysteries to be displayed? The thought of the miracle wrought in the condition of those sleepers filled me with hope that I had misunderstood the meaning of my instructor respecting the exclusion of mercy from this life, and turning to him, I pointed to the couches and asked, "Is it not mercy which has been shown to these in liberating them from their condition of suffering?" "Not by any means," he replied. "By what name do you call it, then?" "Justice. Hitherto they have been the victims of an injustice they were powerless to withstand. We have only been the instruments of helping to terminate the effects of the wrong, and introducing them into a commensurate compensation. You judge of justice in the light of your earth impressions. Let me advise you to get rid of that idea. Justice, rightly dispensed, is justness, and such you will ever find it with us. It is the quality of being just, carried to perfection, with every attendant circumstance taken into consideration. Think of it as such, and you will love its righteousness, in which there is no shade of fickleness, favoritism, or partiality. Would you not call it justice tempered with mercy? No. Strict justice needs no tempering. You have been in the habit of thinking of justice as necessarily allied to oppression. It is so on earth, but you will not find that here. Therefore, you have to learn that with us it means strict rightness. And if you add any mercy to that, on behalf of either party, the adulteration produces injustice. I could see that the error had been mine, due to a misconception and misinterpretation of the word according to the earth impressions. The shadow, which had for a time passed across the firmament of my heaven, was dissolved by his explanation, and my heart again was glad. The work was complete. Siamedes spread his hands to give his thanks to God, while every knee again was bowed as the joyous flashes winged their flight. Then, reverently dismantling his shoulders of that halo, he spread it on the air to receive throbs of praise and adoration that pealed like a great amen, with which it ascended to the Father. Still that audience lingered, the silence growing moment by moment more profound. But I knew they were waiting for the benediction that would rouse those sleepers to the consciousness of life upon which they had unknowingly entered, to the recognition of the restoration which had taken place, to the realization of the fact that death had touched them, and in that touch shackles had fallen away, whose weight before time had exhausted their energies in a painful but unsuccessful struggle. What a revelation! It would be a greater surprise than I myself had experienced. What were their surroundings when the tide of consciousness ebbed away and the cloud of oblivion fell upon them? What a gulf lay between that sleeping and the waking! How would they realize its certainty, how be convinced of its fact? Would not the waking be a dream, a fairy dream, more enchanting than the imagination ever conjured up before? It was a time of supreme suspense to me to watch that advent into the knowledge and realization of immortality, and every sense I possessed was on the alert to follow its development. It was not long delayed. The walls before me opened, and from that arc of light, crowning the zenith of the path on which I stood to contemplate the celestial landscape, a flood of glory fell into the hall, like a harbinger and forerunner of a more resplendent presence still. I looked, and down the halo viaduct beheld a chariot as of burnished silver, flying, drawn by four steeds of transparent creamy whiteness, gifted with the speed of the winds of a hurricane. Time had not opportunity for birth before the equipage was in our midst. Then, pausing for a moment while one of its riders stepped into the hall, it turned and disappeared. The glory road was then withdrawn, the walls were closed, and my attention was riveted upon the stranger. He was a young man, scarcely more than a youth, graceful and noble. The first impression conveyed to my mind was the strange combination of the innocence of the child with the wisdom of the sage, which formed a very striking feature in his person. I loved him the instant I beheld him. His presence inspired my confidence, forbade the approach of fear, but also whispered a caution against presumptuous assumption. In him were blended strength and gentleness, like a bed of down on a granite rock, while he emphasized every quality a man would desire to find in a cherished friend. From his eyes love and patience streamed in a steady, ebbless flow. His mouth breathed the fragrance of fidelity and affection. Upon his shoulders rested the mantle of condescension, and his waist was bound with the girdle of constancy. He was a monarch, but his kingship was of service, and his prowess had been gained in lifting up the fallen. For a brief moment he paused to receive and return the salutation which greeted him, then proceeded to execute his commission by the bestowal of the kiss which should break the seal of that final sleep and usher the sleepers into the day which knows no eventide. Over one and then another he bent his radiant form, loosing the influence of the refreshing spell which still caressed them, and as their eyes opened upon the bewildering scene around, he caught each newborn soul in his strong embrace, lifted it to his feet, and bade it welcome into a life of sympathy and compensation. The revelation and recognition of the truth were simultaneous. It was simply a glance of inquiring wonder, followed by a smile of inexpressible joy. And all was over. With one impulse, the audience rose and sang another chorus. This time it was a welcome home, answered by a pathetic doxology from thankful hearts, the theme of which, words and music, I have tried in vain to learn. And then that magnetic chorale was complete. As the congregation dispersed, the newcomer lingered in the hall in conversation with the Assyrian, and I asked my companion, "Who is he?" "My Hanane," he replied.